So, hello, welcome to the last talk for this day in the Vortragssaal. We have, with greetings from Amsterdam, Gina with the talk, Quantum Random Oracle Model, a user-friendly introduction. So, give it up.
Thank you for the introduction. I'm Gina. I'm a PhD student in Amsterdam. I started half a year ago, and because I had to learn about this, now you get to learn about this. And why do I want to tell you about this? Well, I came across the following scenario, that you have your very fancy new post-quantum cryptography, and it comes in a very fancy box, and it has a bunch of things on the box, and it says it's fast, and it's easy to use, and everything is great, and it's also proven secure. And then there is this very annoying asterisk, and you're like, but if this proven secure has an asterisk, do I really want to use this for my cryptography? And then you zoom in on the box, or you look at the box closer, and you get the following picture. And it might be a bit small, so I'm going to read it. The asterisk says, in the quantum random oracle model under some hardness assumptions. And we're going to ignore the hardness assumptions for this talk. They're very important. Think about them, but I'm going to talk to you about what the quantum random oracle model actually does and why we think it's a useful heuristic. In this talk, we're first going to talk about the what. So what is a quantum random oracle, or what is a random oracle? Then we're going to talk about the why. Why do we actually use this in our proofs? Why do we care? Then we're going to take a short detour towards my actual topic of research, so memory hard functions. And then we're going to end up with the quantum case that is slightly more complicated than the classical one. So let's start with classical random oracles. And random oracles are used in a model. What do I mean by model? I mean something like this. I'm going to try to model these animals. And I have on my slide four pictures. I have an owl, I have a cat, I have a rhinoceros, and I have a cartoon unicorn cat. So if I was, as a human, to classify which of these are animals, I'm going to say these are the animals, right? The cartoon animal, not an animal in my books. Now I want to find a model that is actually very easily describable to a computer. So what I'm going to pick for this model is I'm going to say everything that has four legs. For my computer program, that's going to be an animal. This has two problems. Problem number one, the owl. The owl does not have four legs, but I would classify it as an animal. So we can make an error in this direction. Our model cannot fully encompass the real world. There's also the error in the other direction, which is represented by the unicorn cat. You have something that is actually in your model, but you would not classify as part of your set in the real world. The same thing you can think about with cryptography. So if we have our big wide universe, and you can actually see it, you can have the set, or you can define like everything that is secure cryptography in this world we think about. And then you can define something that is called secure cryptography, assuming we have something called random oracles. And that's what I mean when I say random oracle model. I mean that all of my proofs live in this outer blue box and not in this inner yellow box. Everything that is secure is also secure if I have additional things in my universe, I guess. But the question is, can I actually use this? So what is a random oracle is important to understanding what this model actually does. So we have a random oracle. On the bottom left here, we have our dinosaur representing us. And on the bottom right, we have our oracle, and it's the Oracle of Delphi. And what we can do is we can have some test text or whatever bytes we choose. You can send a picture or whatever. You send it to the oracle. The oracle thinks about it for a sec, then generates some weird number and sends it back to you, right? Fairly easy concept, and this is what we assume we have. So if you think about cryptography, we have this as a tool in our toolbox. So to build cryptography, you can always say, and then I ask the magic oracle for a magic number, and then it will give it to me. The code this magic oracle runs, you can look at it like this. Python code, you have the function oracle, and it takes some bytes as input, and it gives some bytes as output. Easily enough. If my input is not in my storage, then I generate some randomness. So I generate some random string, perfectly random. And then I save it at this input. And then I return whatever I just generated, or if I previously had generated something for this input, I get the same thing back. So if we look at this, if our dinosaur sends the same text again, it will always get the same number. And this has two important features. The randomness, the output is completely random, unless the oracle needs to be consistent. So if you give it the same input, you will get the same output. And that's the what. And now we're going to talk about the why, that might make it a bit more clear why we actually want this. We have something called hash functions in cryptography, and not in cryptography, we just have them, that also takes bytes as input and outputs as bytes. And it's some function that's represented by the dots, some binary operation. So we have this hash function, we have some example text goes in, long string of numbers comes out. And this has basically the same characteristics as our random oracle. First, it's deterministic, that is, I input the same text twice, get the same numbers out. It's implementable, so I can actually have a computer compute this thing, despite like random oracle is like a mystical figure that we could simulate, but we don't really, because we only use it in proofs. And one important thing is the output is constant length. So we always get n bits of output. And now in order to make this a useful thing in cryptography, we want this to be a cryptographic hash function. So we go one step further, and we want one more property from our hash function. And that's pre-image resistance, meaning we make our hash function a one-way street. Given the output, I can know what the input is, but I can't easily find out what the input is. Now, this is a very useful property, but I just corrected myself saying you cannot know what the input is. You can always know, because you have fixed length outputs, so the following strategy for pre-image finding always works. You can just try all of the inputs. You just try a bunch of inputs, and at some point, you have to hit whatever value you wanted to hit. So in this example, we have these numbers starting with 6, 4, and we want to hit this hash value. So we look at our one-way street hash function and input in A. And we notice, oh, this doesn't work. Wrong hash. Okay, we input in B. Also wrong hash, sadly. But now we try all of the letters and then all of the words and whatever. And at some point, we end up at the word coconut, and we notice, oh, this works. Nice. So how long does this actually take? Well, you can compare this to trying out all of the combinations on a combination lock. And who has ever, like, forgotten the combination to a four-digit combination lock knows this is very annoying. And the average time complexity is 2 to the n minus 1, which is cryptographer or like theoretical computer scientist words for this is very annoying. And you don't want to do this. So this is infeasible. And with infeasible, I mean, if we look at hash functions we have, for example, SHA-265, or SHA-3, for example, there are no known collisions. So there is no two inputs that map to the same value, which would be equivalent to finding a preimage. So even with functions that are very widely used, nobody has found, or nobody has told us that they found one. What are uses for these hash functions? First use, you probably know, is file integrity. So if you download your favorite distro's ISO, you always get this, and I know it's not really readable, you always get this long string of numbers, and it says, oh, this is the SHA-265 of the file you should get. And we all always check that this actually matches, and then we're very sure that we have the correct file and no bit flips occurred. Right? At least in theory, you could. Very helpful property in case you're on a lossy connection or you actually think that your mirror might be doing something nefarious. Also, password hashing. We don't save a user's password, we only save a hash of it. That way we can still check the user has the correct password, they know a pre-image. But if someone breaks into our data center, steals our user database, they don't run away with everybody's password that they probably also use for their bank, but they only run away with the hashes, and now they have to do this very expensive, annoying thing of trying all the digits that we don't want to do and that nobody wants to. Another use case that we're going to be going into a bit deeper is digital signature schemes. So what do I mean with this? Well, I'm going to explain to you what hash and sign is. So we have a digital signature, and the first thing is not hash and sign, it's just what a digital signature does. You have your message, and you attach something that is cryptographically authentic, like, make sure this message hasn't been changed. So if I send this, then my partner on the other side can verify, yes, this is still the message they wanted me to receive. If now this message during transport gets changed to something that is not what we wanted to send, something evil, something somebody embedded a backdoor in some image, and this is now sent to my receiver, the receiver can now check, oh, this file has been changed. Great. But some files are very big. Some messages I want to send are very big. For example, if I had written a book and I wanted to send it to a friend, and I want to make sure that they get every bit correct, because if one bit in my book's different, then nothing works anymore, then I could attach a signature. But my book is very long, so this takes a lot of computational power, and the signature gets quite big. So we want to avoid having to do this. And that's where hash and sign comes in. We look at this message now, and it's now blue, which means it has a hash value, and the hash value is blue. The hash value of this message, we can just compute using the hash function. That's fairly quick. And now what we sign is not the actual message, but we sign the hash value. So in this case, we sign the color. What does that mean for my protocol in the good case, where nothing bad happens? Well, we send it over. They take my message, they compute the hash, they see, oh yes, A, the colors match, so the hash values match, and the signature is valid. Great, I actually got the file I wanted to get. Now in the slightly worst case, my attacker actually can interfere with my message, and what they do is they intercept the message and they send a bad one. This message now has a different hash value, it's now orange. But the signature attached is still the signature for the blue hash value. They could also change the signature, but then the signature would be invalid because they can't generate a valid signature for a new message. So what now happens is if I send this forward to my partner, or this is forwarded to my partner now computes the hash value of this nefarious message, notices, oh, this isn't blue, it's orange, and then just aborts and says, this message, I'm not going to do anything with it. I don't trust it. The only bad, and like now we think, okay, this is nice, but there is one bad case that can happen. What can happen is that the attacker, by sheer luck or by knowing something we don't, can generate a message with the same hash value. So this message, this bad message, is also blue. Then the bad case happens that we don't want to happen, because now we still accept this message as valid, because the only thing we check is the color, or the hash value. The thing is now, we still use hash and sign in practice. And the question is, can we actually do this, and why can we do this? When I can, in theory, think of an attack. Well, we can prove this secure in the random oracle model. What do I mean by that? We want to argue that no such attacker can exist. No attacker can exist that is actually computationally feasible, that can actually generate one of these messages that is also blue, that has the same hash value as one of the messages that we've signed. And there's a bunch of computational assumptions here that if you want to know more about them, please ask me later. But the gist of it is, we don't have an attacker that is efficient or like actually computable on a laptop or a server that can do this. But in theory, if we just think about this, if I look at SHA-256, 64, 5 or something. In theory, hash collisions have to exist. So there are two messages that have the same exact hash value, because the inputs, the number of inputs, is so much bigger than the number of outputs. And if I have only 5 possible outputs, but 10 people, some people, or 10 messages, some messages are going to have to be assigned the same number or the same output. So in theory, if I ever find one, or just in theory, this is an existence statement, we have an attacker, and in this attacker's world, which is like this box, the attacker just knows a bunch of collisions for the hash functions I'm using. So this attacker can then now break my hash and sign scheme. Because once I pick one message that is in his large database of collisions, I'm basically screwed. They can inject a bad message. But this is very infeasible, right? Because nobody's come up with collisions. And there has been breaks of hash functions. But we just presume that for the current hash function we're using, we won't have any collisions. Or nobody can know any. But how do we formalize this in a cryptography sense is the question that we have to ask. Because this is a theoretical adversary that can exist, but I want to argue that none exists. So in ROM, we can only find preimages by querying the oracle, right? If I have my magic oracle up in the skies, and it, in every like world, it regenerates for every input one random value, well, if you tell me I want a preimage for the value 5, I know nothing about the internal state of the oracle because it's up in the clouds and I can't know anything. And I'm the attacker. The only thing I can do is go back to trying all the digits on my combination log. I can only brute force. And that's basically the argument we make here, that now the attacker cannot have inherent knowledge about our hash function from just knowing the hash function. So in the random oracle model, this construction can be proven secure. And the proof is a bit more technical than what I just told you, but the spirit is the same. We basically argue, if you want to find the collision, that's either you're incredibly lucky because you tried the letter B worked, yay for you, or you take exponential time, which we find infeasible. So this can be proven secure, and this is how ROM somehow makes this proving a bit easier. So what have I done? If we look at the left side of this diagram, we have an attacker, and in itself, on its own computer, it can compute this hash function. But in the random oracle model, we take this capability from the attacker. We just say, oh, now, instead of computing the hash function, you can query this oracle. And what ROM actually does is, on like a fundamental level, is any attack the attacker has on my scheme, if I prove it secure in random oracle model, has to somehow be related to the inner workings of my hash function, right? If I choose a bad hash function, and the attacker just, for my cryptography scheme, then the attacker can just easily break the hash function and we're just done. But in this model, I just assume, okay, my hash function is perfect. I'm just going to black box that away, and whoever built the hash function is very smart. We're just going to not care. That's what ROM does. We just abstract this thing away. And if we now look at this picture again, we have now seen that hash and sign actually lives in this blue box. Relevant question, does it also live here? Maybe? Well, in theory, attackers exist, right? So as soon as I choose a hash function, an attacker exists. But maybe your definition of secure, and I haven't properly defined what secure means, as you may have noticed, your definition of secure may mean, okay, if I have an attacker that has hard-coded collisions, I don't really care. So that then really depends on your definition of secure. And the next question you might ask is, well, is ROM realistic? Are there even things that are in the blue thing but not in the yellow thing? So that are secure in ROM but not secure in general? Well, yes. Something exists there that has been proven for a fairly long time. So we have schemes there that are secure in random oracle, but as soon as I pick a hash function, just use it, it's going to break. The attacker can win with some probability that we care about. But all of the examples people have given in the past are incredibly contrived. So they're like, oh, I do this normal scheme, but if the attacker can do X, then we just give it the secret key or something. So they're all incredibly non-realistic. So since no really realistic things have been found, people say, okay, ROM is a heuristic, but it's a pretty good one. People trust it. So that might be, that's a very important point, that like, only because something is proven secure in ROM doesn't mean it's secure without any stops. But if it's like a crypto scheme that's actually defined to be secure and somebody tried to build something secure, then it's pretty likely that you can't trivially find an attack. So all of these examples that are secure in ROM but not secure are like built specifically for this purpose. Now for the, I talk about my research for a sec and why ROM is relevant to this. Well, one thing you may have thought about when I was talking about pre-image attacks, you were like, yes, but this is a very bad idea. Why are you brute forcing with only one threat? You could have been brute forcing with all the computers. Yes, I can. And in this example, I still want to find my pre-image to coconut. And instead of taking three steps, once I have three computers and they start at the really right place, well, then it only takes each of them one hash evaluation and we're done. Because the one of the computers just finds it in the first run. You can actually... Sorry. Sorry. You can make this more efficient by implementing this hash function in hardware. Most hash function implementations are incredibly like, oh, now we take this byte and we move it around and then we swap the bits around. Everything very hardware implementable. And you can do this, and it's not the most expensive thing on this planet. If you build your PCBs right, you can have 1,000 of them in a row and be brute forcing on them very happily. And we kind of want to break this. We kind of want to have the attacker not be able to just build a bunch of PCBs. So we need to have this require more resources, right? If I can build a tiny PCB, if I can brute force this on an ESP, well, then it's very cheap to just parallelize a bunch. So what we do is we want to either increase time or memory. Thinking about time for a second, well, if I'm using this for all of my digital signatures and for all of my password checks for users, an additional second is going to be very annoying and the users are going to be complaining. So what do we do? Or you can also do time, but the thing memory hard functions focus on is memory. So what you want to do is you want the attacker to force each of your tiny little boards that brute forces hashes for you has to have a memory chip on them, or has to have two. And that just makes them more expensive to buy and to run. So yeah, that's the main idea of why we want to do this. How do we achieve this? Well, we want still a hash function, but now the hash function is supposed to take some memory. Well, we do it like this. Don't be daunted by the graph. Look at the top left first. There's your input arrow. And it points towards one of your green bubbles, one of our nodes. And the first thing we do is for this node, we compute something we call a label, like this. It's too small. It's the hash function, so the hash value of the number of our node, which is 0, and then string concatenated our input. So if I change my input, well, I'm basically changing the input to a hash function, so the label of this node changes completely. But I can compute this. Then we go forward in our graph, and we say, oh, now we compute this one. We know for node 1, our label becomes, well, we have an incoming error, not from the input this time, but the incoming error is from node 0. So what we do is we say, oh, the label of this is hash function of, then again, node name of our node, so 1, and then added onto that by string concatenation is the label of the 0th node. So now we have hash function in hash function, right? And we can continue this, and we can compute this entire first column, because they all only have like one input, and it just directly comes from above, right? I can just compute them. And then I can go over to the second row, and I'm going to make an example of node 7 here. So if we look at this node, you can see it has two incoming arrows, one from node 0 and one from node 6. So what do we do? Well, we compute as label the hash function of 7, which is the number of my node, string concatenation, label of 6, because that's my direct, like, the one we've computed before, hopefully, and the label of 0. And this now becomes my label. And I go forward through my graph, and I can have arbitrary many layers and arbitrary many rows, and everything's dandy. And then as output, I just output the label of my last node. And you may think about these arrows in the middle. Why do we want them? Why do we need them? Well, if I had just my rows without the arrows in the middle, then I would have just one chain of hash function. That doesn't take a lot of memory, because I need the previous label and the label I'm currently computing. That's two, that's not that much. So what we want the attacker to force to have to do is to store the labels of two of my columns. So you have your first column, you compute this entirely and you put it in some array, and then you compute in a different array your second row. Because if I want to compute label of node 7, but I threw away, for some reason, my label of node 0, then I will have to recompute that. Or guess it, but that's guessing a hash value of some inputs very unlikely to happen to you. So you can try, but you will probably lose. So we have to recompute this value. And these graphs, there's a very nice theory about this called Pebble Games. You can actually prove, oh, you need at least this much memory to compute this graph. Which is very helpful when we want the attacker to have a certain amount of memory. It's also very important that you actually look at the graph and analyze it. This graph is me drawing random arrows. And you can probably do it in way less memory than 2 × 5 hash values. Just because probably you can just recompute some stuff, and probably without losing exponential time, and probably you just don't need to save all the values all of the time. So it's important to look at these graphs in a very theoretical way. But security of this can be proven in RAM. So if I look at my graph and I say, yes, in the random oracle model for this graph, you need at least 20 kilobytes of memory. That's a theoretical thing you can say. One example that uses this construction is the Argon2 hash function. And there are security proofs about their graphs that actually say things exactly like this. They say, if you pick this Argon2 graph, then you need this amount of memory. And I can do this in RAM because I then can replace every call in my attacker with a call to my oracle. And what I can then do is I can follow my attacker along, right? If I have an attacker and I know some Turing machine, right? I consider attackers that are Turing machines. They're kind of boring. We look at this machine and we can run it, right? And when we replace every call to my hash function with my oracle call, then I can, without interfering with the attacker, it can just run as it would. I can look at what the attacker queries. So what an attacker could query just a graph, could try to compute it as I just described, right? You just compute it as the reference implementation does. But we also assume that our attacker doesn't have enough memory, because that's the thing the attacker is trying to cheat. The attacker is trying to make this insecure, where secure means this uses a certain amount of memory. If you now take this attacker and run him in this random oracle model, you can now play the game on the graph by looking at the query, and every time they make a query that corresponds to one of your nodes, you can just say, ah, now they've computed this. And then you can make theoretical arguments, and the argument takes about an hour to make, so I'm gonna spare you this. If you would like to know, please, I would like to share. But yeah. So this can be proven secure in RAM. Because I can somehow learn something about how the attacker works by looking at them through this oracle. So now we're going to come to the quantum part. And the question, okay, what happens now if our attacker is given a quantum computer? So in the classical case, we can look at this and we have our attacker and we replace the hash function with our oracle calls. Nice. Now if our quantum computer, our attacker, is a quantum attacker, whatever that means, they have access to some machine that does the quantum thing. I don't care about the architecture. They can do the following. They can execute the hash function, because it's a computable function, on said quantum computer. And that they can do like without disturbing any state. So what they can do is, instead of only having one input and then correspondingly one output, they can overlay two inputs. What does that mean? That means I represent my bit strings as some, and now architecture-dependent physics thing, typically photons, and you have them in a superposition state, a word you probably heard before. In our case, that just means linear combination. So you have a state, the photons are in some physical order, and that means what the test text, and you have the photons in some other physical order, and that means coconut. And now you have them in a superposition of these physical orders or physical states. What now happens if I apply my carefully crafted quantum algorithm for my hash function is the following. It gives me the overlay of both values. Now, this may not look very readable to you, and it isn't because overlay of text, but now the interesting thing is I can now learn something about either input from one oracle query. I can later decide, did I want to learn the value of test text or did I want to learn the value of coconut? This directly gives you something, by something called quantum search algorithm, directly gives you some speed up in the pre-image finding brute force attack, so the trying all the numbers now gets square root faster. That's okay, but that's kind of a boring advantage, I guess. That's what we consider boring, because you can just double your bit size and then you're fine. So that's not very tangible, I guess. It's still an interesting thing, but we've known this that this can work for a while. So this overlaying is important because this also means another thing. If I try to emulate this using an oracle, well, now I'm given an input that is a superposition of two things, or many different things. I now have to give out a superposition of two values, so I have to pick two values, right? In the classical case, our oracle was fine with, in every call, only picking one random value. But now they have to pick two, which is kind of annoying, or scales pretty badly. So if, for example, our attacker says, I'm now going to be very smart about this, I'm going to input a superposition of all the possible inputs you could have, then I have to pick all of the values because I have to give them back this overlaying. And the value in the back has to the value I output in the back of my superposition, like in this overlaying image in the back, has to correspond to whatever input they gave me on the in the back, and the front has to correspond, and so forth. So I have to pick all of the values. Yeah, so if I'm my attacker and I send him this superposition, then my oracle has to pick two values and they are overlaid. And this oracle obviously doesn't pick them separately and isn't aware this is a superposition of two values. And then it sends it back. Because the following happens. If my text is sent to the oracle and the oracle tries to peek, the oracle decides, screw this, I'm going to have a look. Well, then one of them vanishes. If I try to measure this in the trivial way, then I get one of the inputs my attacker gave me. But then I don't know how many they superpositioned in order to give to me in the first place. And I can only generate one value because I don't know any of the other inputs. And maybe they have queried one of the inputs before. So in this case, maybe they have queried the value of coconut before, and it's 7. And if I now do this, and I measure, and I return something that is not a superposition that contains the value 7, well, then they know I tried to peek. Why is them knowing that I tried to peek a difficult thing or a bad thing? Well, the hash function would never peek, right? If I have a hash function running on my own computer, on my own quantum computer, I would never program it to peek or like to look at this to measure my query. So the attacker can now distinguish the case I'm talking to the Oracle or I'm talking to the hash function. It's no longer as easy as just replacing function calls. Because if I just replace the function calls, well, then it's gonna be broken, I guess. And by the attacker can tell the difference, I mean, the attacker can implicitly behave differently. Because if I'm the attacker, and I send this superposition, and then get back a single value, what does that mean for me? Well, then I think, in some implementations, I could think, oh, I only get back one value, and it's very deterministic. I must have found a collision. But you didn't. The Oracle is just peeking. So this is the difference between random Oracle and quantum random Oracle. You can't see as much, I guess, as the Oracle. And that makes proofs harder, which for a user, probably not the worst thing. You probably don't really mind. I really mind. Makes my life a bit harder. And some notes on why this makes it harder. We can't easily follow the queries anymore, right? In previous examples with my hash function, with my memory hard function, I was like, oh yes, I'm just going to follow them along and find out in which order they computed what, and then I'm going to find the problem in how which order they computed this. I now can't anymore. At the very end, I may be able to see what happened. And there are techniques that somehow alleviate this issue, but it's still kind of annoying. Also, no more trivial lazy sampling. Because as an attacker, the first thing I do, or I can do, is take all of the inputs, superposition them, so linear combinations, all go in, and I have to pick all of the values. So I can't really efficiently implement this anymore. Then there is no rewinding, so I can't rewind my attacker, because now everything's a quantum state and it's a bit annoying. Rewinding in the classical case means, oh, I can just restart my attacker if their behavior, I didn't like their behavior. And also, I can't explicitly set values to something we care about. So in the classical case, you sometimes do something where you're like, ah, once they make this query, then we're going to answer with this hash value, and then they're going to compute something for us that's impossible. We can't really do that anymore in the quantum case. All of these are a bit technical, but that's showing like proofs get a bit harder, but it still works. And this is actually the question my PhD is about. If I find out the answer, I'll let you know. It's whether an attacker has an actual advantage in computing this memory hard function when having a quantum computer. So if I give them this quantum computer that can execute my hash function, can they use less memory? Now, one could argue that a quantum computer is pretty much more expensive than a bunch of RAM chips. But this is theoretical computer science, so I don't really care. No, it's also very interesting in the asymptotic case and for like future applications. But it's not the most practical thing we need an answer to this day or tomorrow. Yeah. Now we have, again, our random Oracle model, and we model our universe, and we introduce a new class. So we now say, well, now we have some cryptography that is secure if I'm assuming I have random I have quantum random Oracle models. And why is this box within the random Oracle model? Well, if something is secure when I can send linear combinations of queries and get answers back, then it's also secure if I can only send one value, because one value is strictly also a linear combination, but a boring one. And now the next question you might be asking is, is there something here? Do we have things that are only secure if the attacker can't use a quantum oracle or can only use a random oracle? Yes, there is. The paper that introduced quantum random oracles actually also introduced one of these separations. It says, yes, actually we need this space here because the something has to fit. That first example was also very contrived. There have now been more natural examples, I would say. So you not only have something where it's like, yes, we're going to do the secure thing, but if you can do the search thing with square root, that basically just proves you have a quantum computer, then we just let you win. You could still have things that actually are an interesting point to make. Why we need to care about this quantum random oracle model, and why we can't just say, oh, ROM is fine. So there are two key takeaways from this talk. First one is QRM isn't scary. If you see it on a paper and you're like, oh, I maybe want to use this crypto thing, but it says it's only proven secure in QRM, you've now seen this heuristic, and you've also seen how it works. And I hope that helps a bit in understanding what it does. It's a heuristic, but it's a pretty good one. So people are arguing about whether ROM and QROM are actual good examples or actual good heuristics, if you actually want to use things that are only proven secure there. But so far, we've done pretty well. And it seems to be working quite well. And the second one is consider switching to post-quantum crypto, or at least hybrid schemes, if your project allows. And there's a bunch of asterisks to this, but consider it. For your new projects, they are fairly mature by now. Thank you for your attention.
All right, Gina, thanks for the lovely talk. So we have like endless time for questions and feedback, right? So, any questions of the audience? People first that don't work in quantum cryptography? Okay. There are several I know. So, yeah.
Oh, hi. Okay. My question regards to IBM's recent roadmap that they published about possibly achieving 1 billion gates and about 200 corrected qubits by the year of 2033, which we all know from a commercial company. Maybe they'll do it, maybe they're not. But like, how does that play into this picture, as in like even post-quantum algorithms by quantum brute force might even be as a question in the picture, like even using quantum proof algorithms, given that they achieved their goal, at least, yeah.
So I'm not an expert on physics and architectures, just up front. So I think it's interesting to consider the security against these devices, even with the devices only on the horizon or only in the very far future on the horizon. I hope I'm understanding your question correctly. Because we can either do it now or we can do it later, but why not do it now? Like, there is no gain in moving this discussion backwards, right? So I guess even if, like, if whether they manage to get their computer running in this capacity or not doesn't really interface with how fast I can do my research.
Okay. You mentioned that if we only assume ROM and not QROM, that we can follow the attacker's steps when he's trying to brute force. What explicit benefit do we get from that knowledge?
Give me a sec. There's too many animations. In this case, what we can show is, looking at this graph, you can play a game with a bunch of tiny pebbles or marbles or whatever, placing a marble on any node where you currently have the label in memory. And if I can follow them around, every time they query a value that is in my graph, I place a pebble, and I keep it there until it's never used again, before it's recomputed. And if I then look at what this pebbling looks like, so this order of how I placed my pebbles, well, I can make theoretical arguments about the best possible pebbling that uses the least number of pebbles, so the least number of memory cells, effectively. And if I find them using a pebbling that is smaller, then I can say, oh, at some point they put a pebble on a stone, but they didn't know both inputs. So that's very unlikely. And then I can make basically an argument being like, oh, but this can't happen in all the cases. This can only happen in a very small fraction of cases. Does that help?
So it's for the proof.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So, five of questions. Ihr könnt sie auch gerne auf Deutsch stellen und Gina oder ich geben uns Mühe, sie auf Englisch zu übersetzen.
Is the post-quantum or a good post-quantum equivalent to sine and hash, hash and sine, whatever? So is it possible post-quantum kind of?
So there are post-quantum signatures. I can't say anything about good, like I will not comment on good. There are signature schemes and they're currently in the process of being standardized. And then you can always do hash and sign because you can just use a hash function and then you use the signature that is post-quantum and based on some things we think is also hard for quantum computers.
So we just go all the way down.
I do have to apologize. It might not exactly be a question. I wanted to add on the further question. I completely agree with you that post-quantum signatures are currently in standardization by NIST, but I did some research about 10 years ago, which basically came out to the fact that if we follow the precise wording of your question, there will not be quantum signatures, because quantum signatures are read-only once memory and thus cannot be third-party verifiable, which is a quality of classical signatures. Just to split the hair. You can show a signature to another third party at a later point in time, because if you received this as quantum information and you read it, it's gone.
Well, we're talking, I think we're talking about post-quantum signatures?
That's the point, he asked about quantum signatures.
Oh, I'm so sorry, I misunderstood your question then. Thank you. Yeah, so the difference he was trying to make is a quantum signature would be you have a quantum state, one of those overlaying thingamajigs. If you read it once, it collapses. You can't read it again. In the post-quantum case, how I understood your question, I'm so sorry I understood you incorrectly, all of this is classical. It's just classical computing where we say, oh, post-quantum means the quantum computer also can't break it, but I don't need a quantum computer to compute it. Yeah, thank you so much.
So, any more questions? Adam.
So, regarding the call to switch to post-quantum cryptographic schemes, there was some recent, relatively recent paper making the rounds about if this is correct, then we suddenly broke a lot of post-quantum schemes that everyone has assumed to be secure. I believe that lattice problems were involved in the statement, and I'm curious if you're familiar with it, and if so, whether it turned out to be legit or whether the authors made a mistake somewhere.
So I didn't read the paper in detail, but the authors commented that, oh, in step 9 of our algorithm, there sadly is a mistake, and they don't know how to fix it yet. So currently we're safe with lattices, and lattice problems are a well-studied problem. Since before the 2000s, if I remember correctly. So yes, this is always a problem. This could also come up with RSA and factoring. So there could be someone who now says, oh, but I can factor numbers in polynomial time, and then we have a way bigger problem on our hands.
I remember happening. But
yes, there was a large commotion, and everyone was very scared. But for now, we seem to be safe.
So, anybody else? Dun, dun, dun. I guess that's it. So, thanks again, and put all the energy you don't want to leave in the lodge into this applause, because it's the last talk for today here. So, give it up! GPMM.